As a horse owner, I always wanted to take the best care of my horses so that riding them was comfortable for them. In the beginning, I didn't realize how complex that care really was. I assumed if I reached out to professionals, they would guide me in the right direction. However, I found out the hard way that it is not that simple. Finding the right professionals can be challenging, and I did not know enough myself to discern appropriately qualified professionals and advice that was accurate. As a result of my experiences and finding that others had similar issues, I decided to start Equitopia as a whole horse, whole rider, evidence-based informational platform that I wish I had access to myself from the beginning. I would like to invite you to visit us at equitopiacenter.com, where you will find this information provided in the form of webinars, blog posts, research papers, and more.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth, the podcast from Equitopia. I'm your host, Kaylee Hansen, and today our guest is Jacques Belew. Jacques is the author of 4 books, including the popular 101 Dressage Exercises for Horse and Rider. She delivers straightforward tools to help equine athletes across multiple disciplines. Combining an expertise in horse fitness and classical dressage, her methods deliver riders measurable success in an environment that prioritizes kindness to the horse.
We can just get started off with how you got into horses.
Well, that's an easy one to answer. I was raised in Vermont. My parents were kind of hippie homesteaders, and they were looking for ways to supplement their income of being homesteaders in Vermont, and they got involved with horses and training horses and teaching themselves as much as they could about it. And so it blossomed into a very well-known and respected carriage driving training center. And I mean, we always cross-trained the horses, so we were always training them to ride as well. But I was raised with it. My earliest memory involves horses and horse chores and lots of frozen buckets and chores in the snow and all that good stuff. So it was a lifestyle for my family, for sure. I never thought I would pursue it professionally. That was not a goal of mine, but as the horse world does, it kept me in its clench this whole time. I'm still engaged. I'm still interested. I'm still curious about it. So I don't find myself able to step away.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. I also never really decided to become a trainer, but it just kind of happened as it does.
Yeah.
Did you have plans to pursue another career, or has it always been horses?
Yeah, so my other passion in life has been writing. And so I went away, not that far away, but I went to Smith College, which was a couple hours from where I grew up, and studied philosophy. And I did a fair bit of freelance writing after graduating from college for various business publications and newspapers, journals, that kind of thing. Absolutely loved it. And I thought that I would pursue that, maybe full time. But what happened was, I was traveling through Europe with, it's so funny because I don't think I would do this at this stage of my life, but youth has a way of making you think you're invincible. So after I graduated from college, I bought a one-way ticket to England, and I lived out of my little backpack and, did some bartending and some hopping around, just living out of my backpack, writing poetry, just living the good life as you do in your early to mid-20s, and not a care in the world, never thought about my own safety, which is why now I don't think I do that. But I ended up in Holland very serendipitously, was sort of working on a dairy farm to make a couple of dollars. And the woman who owned the farm had a brother who was a dealer in very high-end horses. And we dropped by to visit him one day, and being around the horse farm and watching him at a very high level with his horses filled me with longing. And I realized, I'm going to go back to the States. I'm going to start giving lessons and riding horses all day, every day again. And I'm going to do that until it's no longer a passion. Like when it feels like a job, like a J-O-B job, then I give myself the permission to step away, because I feel like I have enough you know, scrappiness and to go do other things and pursue other things. And I do have an education to fall back on, which is wonderful. And, you know, is I've given myself the freedom that the day I wake up and I feel like it is just a grind, I will step away. And, but, you know, luckily, knock on wood, haven't even gotten close to that day. So I give thanks.
Oh, good. Yeah, that seems kind of rare. It seems like there's a lot of professionals where it does become a job and they kind of lose that passion. So I think that's a really wonderful perspective to give yourself that space of like, I'm only going to do this as long as I enjoy it. Because the horses suffer. If you aren't enjoying it and you aren't loving it, the horses can feel that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And since it's okay that we go on tangents there, yeah. It's funny because there's been a shift because there is so much passion and it is a bit of an emotional industry. Like we're all drawn to horses for some for certain things you can name, but I believe there's also this thing that you can't really name or describe. There's something that stirs our soul, you know, it's like a calling. And the downside of being a professional in that industry, I suppose many recreational industries are like this, but you know, sometimes there is the expectation that you're going to work seven days a week. You're going to work tirelessly because this is something you love with a capital L. And in many ways, that's not a fair pressure to put on yourself because you will always burn out. Like we have limited energy. We have limited mental bandwidth as human beings. And we need to change the industry. And so I'm on a bit of, you know, my most recent vengeance has been to raise the professionalism in the industry and also just the awareness that like you can still love something, but also really treat it really professionally, to put boundaries around it, to say, you know what? I'm not going to train 7 days a week. I'm going to take vacations. Now, all of us horse people are guilty of not taking vacations, like barely feeding ourselves the right diet and carving out time for ourselves, right? And to have a very healthy relationship for horses with and for other horse people, I think this is critical. And I applaud Equitopia for, in my opinion, helping raise the bar on just the standard of education, but also how we conduct ourselves as professionals in various facets. And I'm so excited to join, you know, to be a small part of that mission, because it's time here in the US that we treat it as the very legitimate industry that it is. It's not some like kind of wacky side hobby like some people at a dinner party might think. They're like, oh, the horse world, like, you know, can you actually make a living?
Yeah,
that? Like, yeah, absolutely, it's a big industry. So anyway, yeah, just a side tangent to say that's something that I hope to see continue to grow and people to have, for clients to understand more, you know, why there is such a high burnout rate among not just trainers, but vets, farriers, you know, any service provider.
Yeah, most definitely. That's also why I was so excited to get involved with Equitopia, to have all of that information in one place, because it's really lacking and people get most of their information from their trainers, and that can be super biased. And mm-hmm. when you only are getting a lesson, you can't talk about hoof care and nutrition and really dive into that. So I was really excited to be a part of that and have all those resources.
Yeah, the whole picture. Mm-hmm, totally.
Yeah. I feel like the burnout is part of a bigger part of our culture as well, of like hard work is great and the more you work, the better you are. But when you get burnt out, like your nervous system gets dysregulated, that happens to the horse. And I think we really need to appreciate when trainers go on vacation and take that time to themselves, like making sure you're able to spend really good quality time with the horses, if that means taking less horses on or just finding that balance. So
yeah,
I think the clients have to learn to accept that as well.
Yeah, and it's part of us communicating to them. And again, communication is something we're all of us always trying to get better at. But I think it just helps for them to hear from you that, hey, I'm a human being. You know, I am a trainer and it is something that I'm deeply invested in. I'm also a human being. And to your point, I don't have, you know, a nervous system that can sustain this day after day. So communication, right?
Yeah.
Not just with our horses, but each other.
Yeah, definitely. Because I feel like how we interact with our horses is also how we interact with people and the world. So the better that we can communicate with each other, the better relationships we can have with our horses.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your transition into training full time? So you came back from Holland. Did you do an apprenticeship or did you just start offering? What was that transition like?
Well, I was really lucky with my upbringing to have, I mean, I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but to have a very, I was exposed to a lot of different, what we would now call disciplines. I mean, you know, back then in New England, if you had a horse, you kind of did everything with that horse. You drove him, you rode him, you did some competitive trail riding. You also mm-hmm. took him to the summer dressage schooling show. I mean, you just kind of did everything. Like, we were cross training without calling it cross training.
Yeah.
So I'd been exposed to a lot of different things, which was great. And, you know, it's pretty well rounded. When I came back and began teaching, I was still based in New England. I was giving lessons and, then I very quickly started traveling to Europe, primarily to Portugal. So for 10 years in a row, I went over to Portugal in the winters and I would take students along. And that was just a wonderful time. I have the fondest memories. But, you know, then anyway, I was exposed to a higher level and a particular way of dressage training that I loved, you know, lightness and just taking the time with exercises. There wasn't this sort of frenzied, heavy, what I call on the muscle kind of riding. So that really opened my eyes to sort of an artistic way of riding that really appealed to me. And I think also embedded in me a love of Iberian horses, which is how I ended up in California. There was an opportunity to come out and train for a woman who was importing Andalusians from Spain. And that for me was a dream. And I came out here and I cannot believe it was 20 years ago at this point. I kept thinking I would go home to Vermont, has been my plan all along. But you live out here long enough and you get pretty soft. And I'm okay with being soft and it being 60 degrees on a wintry day. I'm just fine with that. So I don't think I'm going to move back to Vermont to be a full-time horse.
Yeah, the weather out here is great. I don't know how people do it in the really cold places.
I don't know how they do it either. So, you know, as part of my traveling around, so I went a lot to Portugal, but then I also went to the riding school, and I don't know if it's still there, but there was a riding school in downtown Amsterdam, which was really fun. Oh. It was really fun. And then there, I also went over when Arthur Cotes was still the head rider at the Spanish riding school in Vienna. I went there mm-hmm. for a trip and did an article with him for Dressage Today magazine, back when that was a magazine. And so, you know, I just got exposed to, and then I had the chance to ride with the late Egon Van Nijndorf, which was wonderful. So I got exposed to a lot of different, you know, approaches to dressage anyway. And that led to writing my first book, which feels like, you know, it was back in the dinosaur ages, but that was 101 Dressage Exercises for Horse and Rider. So I found that in the various approaches, whether you were quote unquote classical dressage or a different kind of dressage, I found that the way these trainers disseminated what they wanted riders to learn was different than how we did it in the US. Mainly, they put you through exercises, and the exercises in the horse taught you what you needed to learn. Whereas in the US, I felt like we would spend more time like describing things and getting people a little bit too much in their head. Mm-hmm. So I was inspired to write some of these exercises down and come up with diagrams. And so that was my first book. And it has been really successful. And I loved the process of writing books. And anyway, so now I've written 4 books and mainly exercise based, because I am a fan of keeping people out of their heads. I mean, there's value to thinking about something for sure. Yeah. But you can also overthink things. And when you're on the back of a horse, sometimes it leads to not the most productive use of those moments. So, that sort of started my trajectory as an educator and author and whatever other hats I currently wear.
Definitely. Got to be well-rounded. Yeah, I have the 55 corrective exercises also the 101. And they're so useful, especially to give the clients to have a framework of here, you can go practice this, especially because a lot of people don't have access to good trainers. So I think having those concrete exercises to do is super valuable because you can read a lot of theory, but then it's hard to always translate that if you don't have a vast already understanding of everything.
Oh, absolutely. And if you've never had a chance to ride, you know, a horse that's super in balance, like you can have an idea what that might feel like, but you don't know. To some degree, you're kind of feeling around in the dark, trying to create something you've read about or your instructor has told you about or something. But if you can find exercises that help put you and the horse in balance a little bit more quickly, and like I say, with less sort of getting stuck in your head, I think you get these little feels that then you start to connect together and you can make more progress, as you say, especially on your own. If you don't have eyes on you to help you, it's incredibly valuable.
Yeah, most definitely. What was your transition into more of like the postural activations and moving a little bit more towards the corrective exercises?
I think it's happened gradually over time. But I mean, as you know, to me, dressage is basically the physical therapy and training of the horse. That said, so a lot of times just riding your horse in a very correct way is all they need. However, I don't know if it's that our industry has changed or I have changed or both, but I did start to notice, you know, about 10 or more years ago, that horses, even with good correct training, had certain physical conditions they were not overcoming in the way that an athlete with good training should. And so it started to occur to me, wait a minute, these horses don't have the living environment, as an example, like the living environment they might need, right? Maybe they're too confined. They do not have access to open land to move around and just be horses. Or, here's a bunch of horses who have really poorly balanced feet or really poor diets. Like they're all pumped up on sugar. And so their muscles are in this chronically hyped up and contracted state. So I started to realize that a lot of the ways that we were just keeping them, caring for them, et cetera, was really inhibiting our training. And so we needed to mitigate some of that. And so I started to just play around with a lot of basically rehab kind of exercises. So I'm always learning. I read and study anything I can get my hands on. So I did take the equine exercise physiology class from the University of Guelph, which was terrific. I read every physiology article and book I can get my hands on, in addition to my dressage background. And I've just been playing around over the years with a lot of these exercises. And I was like, wait, a lot of these exercises are not just useful in a rehab situation, but they're also, prehab or just as an ongoing sort of mobility routines, if you will, to help the horse just be able to access his body. Because as I said, a lot of the ways we keep horses, and no judgment, I mean, depending on where you live, you may just not have access to all of the amenities you might want to give your horse, you know. And the other thing that really broke my heart is I was repeatedly hearing over and over and over, like, so I wrote my equine fitness book several years ago, and you know, some people would contact me and say, I have your equine fitness book and it's great, but I can't use the material yet because I have a horse that was injured with XYZ injury, whatever. And they had done whatever the treatment was for the injury. And the vet would then clear them after, you know, whatever period of layup and say, okay, you're good to go back to work. Well, imagine how daunting that is for a horse owner. It's like, whoa, like what? Like, how do I just go back to work? Like, what is that? Like, how do I get there? Like from zero to where I was? Like what? And I was finding that vets, you know, possibly because they're just so busy, or I don't know if they have the protocol for writing up a conditioning plan. But I was finding that students didn't have that. And it was breaking my heart because they would either become inert with not wanting to damage their horse and just sort of like, you know, locking up and not doing anything, which as we all know, is it makes the horse worse physically. Or they would try to just pick up wherever they left off, you know, a month, 3, 6 months ago and re-injure the horse. So I started to just be really break things down into tiny steps and put them together into plans and programs for people to follow. And it has been so rewarding. It's so rewarding to hear from people I've never met to be like, oh my gosh, you know what? Thank you for the people just want help. They just want you to tell them, hey, do these steps because they don't know where to look. So now I'm just like a vigilante about the corrective exercises because I see how they work and they are so effective and they're so simple and they're so stress free. And as I was talking this morning in a Facebook live chat, I was sharing with people, it's also a good way to observe your horse, to check in with how's his nervous system responding to this? How's my energy? How am I interacting with the horse? It's just, they're great check-ins. So hopefully I answered your question somewhere in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like doing the corrective exercises are really good too for people to kind of get out of the training idea. Well, you're always training your horse, but people can get a little bit too goal-oriented of like, this is what I'm having to do. So I think spending that time, especially with the massage or like the Masterson method stuff, of just observing and hanging out with your horse. Because they're social creatures. And imagine if someone came over to you and every time you saw them, they made you work, you're not going to enjoy them as much. So it's taking that time to really analyze and hang out with your horse is really useful.
There's value in it. And I think a lot of times we all need to be reminded of that. Like, this is productive. This is time well spent. And so for people who are skeptical, and that's fair enough, but I always tell them if these corrective exercises or like the Masterson techniques, if they look like kind of silly to you, like, well, what's the point? You're totally fair to think that, but just try it out, you know, just give yourself a favor, just try it out. If you still think, well, that was silly, I didn't accomplish anything, that's totally fair. But do your horse and yourself the favor of just trying it.
Most definitely. Did you have a specific horse that really changed your approach to things?
I wouldn't say there was a specific horse, but there was a very definite specific moment. So many, many years ago, I was training a young Lusitano stallion, and he was such a sweetie. I loved him. He was a little bit phlegmatic. You know, he was a sweetheart. He was mentally engaged with me, but he really did not have a gas pedal. He was pretty stuck in first gear. And I was getting a bit frustrated, and simultaneously around this time, I saw a flyer posted somewhere for the first U.S. clinic with a trainer I'd never heard of at that point. I don't think anybody here had, and it was Manolo Mendez. And he was going to be at this barn close to me, and I thought, well, this person probably understands the Iberian horses. And I asked this horse's owner, can we take the horse to this clinic? I've never met the guy, but in the picture, he looks very kind. That's what I said. And so we went and, you know, it's just so funny to look back on because they couldn't fill the clinic. There were literally two participants in Manolo's first clinic.
Really?
It was me and this other woman who had trailered down from the North Bay. I was so enthralled by that clinic. He was supposed to teach a second day. And I said, I'm going to bring every horse in my barn. I will fill your second day, all me, all my horses. And from then on, I went to host his clinics in the U.S. for many years and traveled to Australia to study with him 3 times. But anyway, when the horse and the situation that really shifted me was when I unloaded that stallion from the trailer, I backed him out of the trailer and Manolo just happened to be standing there. And the next thing I know, he's on the ground, like crawling around on his hands and knees, looking at the horse's hooves. And I was like, well, I didn't even, you know, I'm like, I don't know this man. What are you doing? Because I was used to very traditional dressage clinics, right? Mm-hmm. And here's this guy in the dirt crawling around my horse's feet. And he's like, oh man, these horses' feet are all out of balance and there's all this pressure here and there. And he looks at me, he goes, I bet this horse doesn't like to move forward. And I was like, yeah, that's why I'm here. And he's like, no, these feet are all the problem. And today, to me, that seems really simple. But back then, I had never been to a dressage lesson or clinic where they commented about anything but my riding. Mm-hmm. There was never any like, well, what's this horse's lifestyle like? What's his diet? How do his feet feel? And it was such a shift. I changed the way I did everything after that. Mm-hmm. And it definitely sent me on a journey that sometimes alienates me a bit from, you know, more modern dressage folk. Not always, but sometimes they don't really know what column to put me in. But yeah, that moment, that horse, and once we fixed his feet, gosh, he had so much energy. He was such a good boy. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of times, not always, but it seems like a lot of times when a horse is having like training or behavior issues, it seems like oftentimes it's a physical problem or they're stressed or they're anxious. And if you can just fix what's actually causing it instead of wasting time and energy and frustration trying to train it out of them, it makes everyone's life so much easier.
That's true. It's almost too simple in a way, you know. They're so good though. You're right. They're such good animals. Usually if something's not going according to plan, we just zoom out. We can figure it out. Yeah. I mean, if you're looking for the right stuff.
Yeah, most definitely. What year was that when he first came over?
I'm trying to think. I want to say it was around 2006, maybe.
Okay. Is he still coming out?
He doesn't travel much to the U.S. anymore. I believe he has come to Texas in the last few years, but it's been a few years. So most recently, I have the great honor of hosting Dr. Gerd Heuschmann when he's in the California to give clinics. In fact, he'll be here in 2 weeks, which I'm so excited about. So he is also a guiding light and just right now definitely a North Star for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really excited for that clinic. I'm going to the one at Equitopia.
Oh, great.
So cool. Let's see. From that, maybe you could go into when you are getting a horse in for training or a clinic, what's kind of your process of analyzing that horse to figure out where the problems are?
Well, that's an interesting question because I think there's always, for me anyway, I think there's always an assessment of like, in terms of, well, what are the problems? There's the way I could approach it, which would be like, okay, if this were my own horse, what would I tackle first? But mm-hmm. if the horse is owned by another person, there's always, for me to be fair, to try to get clear what that other person, wants the outcome to be. And to approach the scenario starting from there. So, you know, for example, sometimes people will bring me a horse and they're just like so physically uncomfortable. They're kind of like, you can't even tell where they're lame. They're like lame everywhere. You know, you can't even pinpoint it. They're sore. They're grouchy. They're not that engaged with people. And if I ask the person like, well, you know, what's the hope here? Do you want to get back to riding this horse? At a high level, do you want to just trail ride? Like, what's the goal here? Sometimes there's a difference between what they tell you and what they might actually want. So parsing that out is part of the equation. But also knowing what their expectations are for the horse is important for me. Because it's not fair for me to approach a horse and be very picky with his balance or require that he's like, you know, laser tuned on my aids. If, for example, the person just wants to trail ride and maybe their position is not very quiet, maybe their legs bang around a little bit or something. So in that case, making the horse, very sensitive to my leg would not be fair to him, because then he's going to get mixed signals when his rider climbs up. But that might be separate from your question. Usually where I start is just sort of observing the horse. Do they seem comfortable in their body? And I know a certain amount can be gleaned right from the outside, right? Like, is there life in his eyes? Does his coat seem shiny? Does he seem to know where his feet are when he's moving around? Or is he sort of disengaged from his body? Like, he's not even occupying his body. A lot of times I look at the back. I think the back is everything. You know, if a horse gets sore, it's gonna affect the back. If they have sore feet, if they pull a hamstring, if they have jaw problems, it is going to end up in the back, and the back muscles become deactivated. So I usually look at when they walk and trot and maybe canter a little bit. Does it look like there's some movement flowing through the back, like, you know, lines of energy that travel all the way through the horse? Or does there seem to be kind of a dead spot there in the middle? And then depending on the horse's like their feeling or their engagement with humans, that sort of dictates where I would take them with their training, like what kinds of corrective exercises. So for horses that are sort of like wound up and, you know, kind of reactive, I don't do certain inertial drills, for example, like lots of transitions or ground pulls in tight sequences, because it tends to just get those horses even with more fire in the belly. And what we need to do is bring their nervous system down. So I might do like ridiculously simple. It might mean to other people, it would seem really simple and remedial, but I think it's what those kinds of horses need. So, you know, for example, the exercise in my book of straddling a single pole, we might just hang out there. We might just straddle that pole and hang out there, and that might be good. And I put them away and come back. So for horses that come to me for like kind of a physical rehabilitation scenario, I frequently get them out 3 to 4 times a day for short sessions. Like, that's my favorite way to approach them. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the best way to access their neuromuscular system without taking it to the point of fatigue where, you know, past which point you're not making any gains. So, yeah. But with horses that are, you know, kind of older, they don't have any quote unquote major problems, if we're just sort of working on moving forward, then it's, you know, a longer session generally. Sometimes I'll still do double sessions with them, but it's a longer session each day. And then I just am adamant about varying what we do each day, you know, having a really varied program with Cavaletti, with riding out. You know, they don't have to go on long trail rides, but in my world, they do have to ride out. They have to go for at least a couple mile hack down the road and interact with the world. Super important. Mm-hmm. It's become more and more important the older I get.
Yeah. It's good for their minds. And then they experience new things, and they're able to be curious, because they're very curious animals. So
yes. Yes.
Going outside is so good for them. What are some of the more common problems you see with horses?
So, well, in terms of their rideability, I would say, you know, just hollowness is still a big challenge for a lot of riders. A lot of riders know their horse shouldn't be going around like a giraffe with his head in the air, but they can't consistently sort of resolve the problem. So that's a chronic one.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what we could generally define as just, well, I call it bone rattling movement, but, you know, riding horses that aren't comfortable. And, you know, as Dr. Heuschmann always says, a horse that is comfortable in swinging through his back should be comfortable to ride. I mean, it's not as effortless as sitting on your couch, but it shouldn't rattle your dental work around, right? So, but a lot of horses, in fact, I get a lot of endurance horses, like 50-mile, 100-mile endurance racing horses who show up looking for lessons or training to make their movement a little bit more fluid and efficient, so they're not just slamming on their forelimbs and straining, you know, all those lower limb tissues, bone, hoof. And those are fun. Those are rewarding. So those are some common ones. You know, sometimes, well, we've already touched on it. A lot of times in clinics, I'll see kind of generally sluggish. I don't want to say behavior, but horses that seem to have their foot on the brake pedal. Mm-hmm. That's also a common thing that I encounter. I will say, though, that's tricky to parse out because I won't spend too much time dwelling on this, but I think sometimes many horses either become sluggish or are labeled as sort of sluggish or not very forward, when in reality, the rider might psychologically actually not want them to be a lot more forward. And that might be from like a safety standpoint. They might feel like they don't like that volume of energy when the horse is more forward. So over time, you sort of put the lid on that. Or from a fitness standpoint, there is, you know, a good measure of rider fitness that is necessary to really ride a horse, walk, trot, and canter in a good forward rhythm. It's not like running a marathon, but there's a certain degree of fitness. So, you know, I think riders past a certain age or fitness level might struggle a bit to get their horses really moving forwardly like they want. So then the horse over time adapts, because horses are good natured like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But then they get wired that way to be a little bit pokey in their gait. So that's another common one I see. What are some common ones you see? Problems or things that need resolving?
Kind of those similar ones. I feel like I see a lot of just kind of misunderstanding of how their aids are affecting the horse and giving kind of like opposing aids. They're just not truly understanding what the end goal is for the horse, and kind of that lack of understanding of a training methodology. So they'll maybe do an action, but they don't understand how that puzzle fits into or how that piece of the puzzle fits into the whole picture.
Yeah, no, that's important. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, because there's so many resources available to riders now, which I think is wonderful. I mean, it's different than when I grew up. You had to like go get a physical riding lesson. There's different ways to do it now. But I mean, you can get a little mixed up. And I don't think there's only one way to train a horse or even to ride dressage. But I do think you have to be on a path. And that's where it gets hard. Like if you're just... like if you're an amateur or you're new, like you don't know what path you're trying to follow. You don't even know what the options are, right? So you might take some info from over here and then take some info from over there, but they might be from different paths. And then when you try to blend them together, your horse can be very confused, right? So, you know, like the contact's a classic example. Like we want the horses to reach into our hands in a very light contact. It should never be like pounds of pressure, but there should be a connection between the rider's hands and the bit. But when I served on the advisory board for the Western Dressage Association of America, that was really fun because you did have people from a very different path. And like I say, I'm saying there's one way that's right or wrong, but to them, they didn't want the horses to take contact. And we had to figure out how we were going to write the rules for the Western Dressage, because for many people, based on their background, they wanted the horse to move with an arched, you know, neck and back, but for the reins to be loose. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is, if you're a rider that kind of, you know, dabbles a little bit with wanting that outcome, but then you're giving the horse a cue to physically stretch into the contact, like you know, to your point that you just made, well, then you've just given him like really conflicting like aids and what the outcome should be, right?
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. Are there any like common physical problems that you see in the horses that cause certain behaviors?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, a lot of tight necks, you know, and a lot of horses are using their neck to kind of pull themselves along. And so you get, you know, rigid pockets of muscling along the sides of the neck. That's a pretty common one that I see. Tight hamstrings is another common one. Especially for people that do long trail riding, the hamstrings can get tight and the horse can kind of start to drag his toes and go with a really choppy gait in the trot. Those are common ones. But then, as I said, just a lot of back, I'll just call it discomfort. You know, I think kissing spines has been so highly diagnosed in recent years. I think our diagnostics have possibly gotten better. But I also just think we're waking up to the fact that many, many horses are uncomfortable in their back, whether that's hypertension in the lower lumbar or actual spinal impingement. I do think that releasing the back, you know, in Chinese medicine, the back is the emotional filter, right? So there's the mental and physical piece of it for the horse's back. Like, are they relaxed through the back? Okay, that's where we start. Now, can we talk about helping them engage and move through the back properly? It's complex. It's a complex puzzle.
Oh, that makes sense. I did not know that the back was like the emotional center in Eastern energy work.
Yeah. And so I mean, if you think about it, if somebody who's very anxious or, you know, suffers in certain ways with mental illness, almost always there's a correlation with back pain, back tightness, shoulder tightness. So it's kind of a mirror in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty true of the horses. I mean, I'm not a body worker, but I love to listen in on body workers and say, yeah, that makes sense for how this horse is wired emotionally.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense with the bladder meridian line for the Masterson method. I was doing that on one horse. I'm studying body work through equinology, but I also took a Masterson method weekend course. Okay. And I had one client horse who just very anxious, just very insecure horse. And I was just doing the bladder meridian, and it was amazing the emotional release that I had from her. Mm-hmm. That's so cool. And just seeing her entire demeanor change without even touching her, just having your hand hovering above. And then by the end, it was like as if I had picked up all of her emotions and was crying. And I was like very taken aback by it. Wow. So that makes sense with the back and all of the emotions there.
That's so cool. That is so cool.
Yeah. It was really cool. I was like, wow, there's... I felt like I was pretty in tune with horses before, but then after that Masterson method workshop and looking really at their eye and the blinking and the twitching, I was like, man, there's so much I have not been seeing.
Yeah, I know, huh? Just when you think, yeah, I'm pretty in tune. And then you realize, oh my God, there's so many more layers to be in tune.
Yes.
Every day.
Most definitely. And it can definitely get overwhelming when you start noticing all these things that you didn't before, but then if you don't quite have the tools to really change and interact on that level.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's where I'm at right now. I'm like, oh man, there's so many things I want to learn and know, and now I got to learn how to do it all.
Oh, well, we have many lifetimes. We'll get it
all
done.
Yes, we do. That's what I love about riding is there are many lifetimes to learn from. And then what are some actions people can take to improve their like riding or the quality of life for their horse?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously I can only give you my own little feeble opinion on the matter, but you know, I think the biggest thing is to, as I've referenced before, finding a living situation that really fosters the way horses should live. They should be social. They should eat very little sugar in their diet. They do not need to be filled up with supplements. They should have as much movement as possible. And I know many people have to keep their horse at a boarding facility, and finding all of these elements can be very hard. However, in my world, they are so important because they determine the horse's behavior and what state his nervous system is in, his trainability, all of these things, which steers your own horsemanship, right? So... To me, it is worth choosing, just being very particular about where you choose to put your horse and do it. I'm so impressed with people who are committed to the message that like Equitopia is putting out and what I'm saying right now. Like I have many people right now who are just in the deep throes of winter, like people in Northern Canada. Like I can't even imagine how cold it is. And they have so much snow. They send me pictures. There's so much snow. And yeah, their horses live out, but there's so much snow they physically cannot move around, right?
Yeah.
And so these people are so committed. You know, they get their horse a daily allotment of movement, whether that means walking them up and down the barn aisle, because that's all they have, you know, or throwing salt down to melt the ice in the driveway so they can do some laps around the driveway. But it's so important to make sure those basic horse needs are met because it affects the entire picture. And I wish I'd known that like when I was a younger trainer, because I spent so much time, you know, fighting tension or, you know, horses who were distracted or horses that were stiff or whatever that I could have addressed with their living situation, you know, their daily movement, their diet. So that's at this point in my life, my biggest recommendation for people.
Yep. That's kind of mine too. Growing up, I was really fortunate that our barn was only 5 minutes from my house, but every day, every morning I would go and turn my horse out in the big 50 acre field and every day bring her in, whether it was raining and I had to walk like the 30 minutes to the back of the field to get her. So I'm really grateful that that was instilled into me that horses need to be horses. Mm-hmm. And you have to make it a priority, but it's really hard to find facilities that have turnout.
It's hard.
It's so hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially in that are affordable too. So I like that of just even if you go out in the morning and walk your horse down the aisleway just so they can get more movement.
Yeah. And it all counts. Sometimes we think, you know, movement is movement, but sometimes we think, well, I'm not like training him. I'm not doing groundwork. I'm just walking my horse around. But we forget, like, look at your own life. Movement counts, right? If you park your car further from the grocery store so you have to walk a bit more, that's great. Movement and exercise is wonderful. And it all counts. It doesn't have to, you don't have to go to a gym to get your exercise. In the same way, your horse doesn't have to be doing a training session, but he does need movement. They need daily movement, and it can take all forms.
Definitely. All right. And then I'm going to leeway into these other questions. But what books do you recommend most to people, and what books have greatly influenced you?
You know, it's funny. I early on, I think I recommended books. I don't even think they're in print anymore, but my favorite basic dressage book for people used to be The Dressage Formula by Eric Herbermann. And I don't know. Do you know? Is that book still in print? I feel like
I'm not sure.
Anyway, it was terrific because it was really basic. It was based on classical principles. It was very slender and simple. And the photographs were wonderful. And he was riding like normal horses. So that is to say, not super flashy warm bloods. Anyway, he was just a delightful instructor. Anyway, so I always used to recommend The Dressage Formula to people as a basic dressage book. I always loved anything about Nuno Oliveira. And there was a book, I think, published posthumously, called Notes and Reflections on Equestrian Art that had some just delightful quotes and philosophies of Nuno Oliveira. So I loved that one. But for people who want just a really sound understanding of the horse's body mechanics, I almost always recommend The Way to Perfect Horsemanship by Udo Berger, which is terrific. And then I always recommend people read Dr. Gerhard Heuschmann's book. He has a few, but and they're all worth reading. Obviously, Tug of War was what put him, I think, on the map for many people. But also, my publisher, Trafalgar Square, just reissued his book called Balancing Act. And I absolutely love it. And it's basically like, how do we reconcile our modern like demands and wishes for our horses with correct sound training? And it's a delightful book. That's called Balancing Act. And so, like I said, that is, again, newly available as of, I think, last year from Trafalgar Square here in the U.S.,
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've read the collection or contortion and the tug of war, and those ones are so good.
They're so good. I mean, it reminds us horses were not their backs are not designed to be ridden. So
no.
Let's take the training seriously.
Yes, most definitely. And then you should say you have 4 books, right?
Yeah. Maybe so my first one was 101 Dressage Exercises for Horse and Rider. And then I wrote Equine Fitness, which is a conditioning guide. And that has 50 exercises in it that are fitness based for horses. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote 101 Western Dressage Exercises for Horse and Rider. And the difference there between that and the English one is the exercises in that book emphasize more the requirements for a Western Dressage horse or a trail riding horse. So there's more maneuverability patterns and more ground pull related exercises in that one. Mm-hmm. And then my most recent book is the 55 Corrective Exercises for Horses. And there's all kinds of suggested routines in there, including ones for gated horses, because that is a growing population in our country that have come to me for a lot of help to get their horses' bodies organized too. So,
oh, cool. Yeah, that seems helpful. Cool. And then how has a failure or an apparent failure set you up for success later in life? Do you have a favorite failure?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah, I feel like every day is some conglomeration of failures and successes. But to be honest, I feel like when I moved to California, I felt like it was a big failure. I was a little bit lost, you know. I think the ultimate goal of the position that I took to move out here was to be really competitive dressage rider and do a lot of showing and preparing for showing. And you know, I was young enough to think that might be what I want, but obviously that was not my inner core. And anyway, that position didn't work out for a variety of reasons. And I found myself sort of stranded out here in California, and it was the middle of winter and I didn't really know anybody. And I thought, wow, I just took a big expensive college education and basically flushed it down the toilet. I'm living, you know, I was cleaning some stalls to make ends meet. And I thought, what did I do moving out here from all the way across the coast where my family is and everything? And I, there was a very, he's a very dear friend of mine. He was he still trains up in the Auburn area, cowboy. And he had taken some lessons from me. He trained Arabian show horses at that time. And he was trying to up his game in the dressage world. And he couldn't even find his way around a 20-meter circle at that point. And anyway, he and I became friends and we started training together, and he helped get me on my feet. And he's one of the best horsemen I've ever met, Mark Sherman. To this day, we're very dear friends. And he, you know, his friendship and our collaboration together is what kept me in California. And I don't think many people know that. And, anyway, I'm very grateful to him, and he just believed in me, and together he taught me the power of trainers being able to work together, because his strengths were all my weaknesses and vice versa. And mm-hmm. it was wonderful to be able to admit, like, hey, I don't have all the answers, but Mark sure has a bunch that I don't have. And he could say the same of me. And so I've been on a mission to foster that kind of collaboration with other trainers, because I do believe it can exist. I've experienced it. But anyway, so that was, you know, going from a very dark place to thinking, wow, I just screwed everything up, to slowly and surely pulling those bootstraps up and being like, no, I can do this. I can figure this out. And so here we are 20 years later, and I sure am glad I stayed.
Yeah. I feel like that's a little bit rare of having that collaboration between trainers, but it's becoming more common. When Mary Wanless comes down for her workshops afterwards, she'll have kind of a just like a meeting with everyone who attended, just so we can relate and help each other, because at the end of the day, we all want our horses and riders to be happy. So I love focusing on collaborating more, because we all have different strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, and different ways we can or can't communicate, different levels of, you know, social engagement with people. Some of us are super people oriented and others are not. And we all just have different strengths and weaknesses, and we need a network, as much as we all might hate to admit that, but we need peers and colleagues we can call up and be like, man, I got this problem. What do you think about this? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. And then what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Well, that's a funny one. It's not super new, but it's, you know, new in the last 10 years or so. But I was introduced to long distance trail running. And I, even though I've been sort of athletic my whole life, I'd never been a runner, and certainly not like in the middle of the forest for long hours. Mm-hmm. I fell head over heels in love with trail running, and I absolutely love it. And it has been so important for me because I like challenges. I like physical challenges. I like to have, you know, certain goals and be a little bit competitive about them. And it has given me an avenue that does not involve horses, where I can be a little bit of a guinea pig myself for some of the fitness ideas I might hold, and to learn how much a body that's cared for really can do. Our bodies are amazing. And so I've gotten into running like 50-mile, 60-mile races. And,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, and it's a whole world. Actually, I have a colleague who's in Santa Fe who I'm like, you're my doppelganger. Like, she runs 100-mile races, and she's also a dressage trainer, and she's the only other one I know so far that has this passion. But it has definitely been a gift. A delightful gift. I can go decompress at the beginning or end of the day in the redwood forest, and, you know, solve problems.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. Did you find that increase in your fitness made you a better rider?
Yeah, I think so. And vice versa. So interestingly, the adductors, which we dressage riders use a lot, they, over the course of like an ultra marathon, you've been running for 10, 11 hours. If your adductors are responsible for keeping you upright, you know, partly. And for many runners, they start to cramp and kind of give up, especially based on your electrolyte levels after like a marathon distance. But it might be a superpower of equestrians that they can run longer because we have strong adductors. So that's been great. But I find that the fitness that comes from my running is excellent cross training for the riding, because I did used to suffer from like a fair bit of kind of lower back tension and, you know, certain tight spots from the repetitive movement of riding horses, because I still ride 3-4 hours a day every day. So a lot of that, funny enough, is balanced out with the running. I feel like it's a good antidote.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of people forget too, we know riding is work, but I think a lot of people forget how much of an athlete you have to be. Like, I notice a huge difference in my riding, whether or not I'm active and doing yoga or working out outside of it. Mm-hmm. It just makes it easier, especially when you're more tuned into your body and the different muscles in your body and not getting as fatigued.
It's so true. Yeah. And I know it can be hard to find that time, but again, I like to remind people there's all kinds of movement. Like, yoga is awesome. I love it. But if it's not somebody else's cup of tea, well, don't think you have to do that. You could maybe get into walking, or there's all kinds of things. But to your point, I think a lot of extra movement, when you can find things you enjoy, you will find the time for them, and they will contribute to your riding. It'll improve.
Yeah, absolutely. And then to finish off, what are bad recommendations you hear in your profession?
Well, let's see, right? I mean, just off the cuff, nothing's like, I'm not coming up with a specific. I would say generally, the overthinking of things is very prevalent. I believe what I have seen in the last couple of decades is this move towards specialization in the horse world. So, like, I explained my upbringing, like, we didn't have specific disciplines that a rider or a horse did. Like, a horse is just kind of a horse. Now, you know, you meet a 3-year-old and people want to know what discipline that horse is going to do. It's going to be a dressage horse, it's going to be a jumping horse, it's going to be a, I don't know, working cow horse or whatever. And I think there's just a move way too early to start specializing. And then, so what's happened is the industry has become pretty boxed up. So like the dressage people don't speak to the whatever Western people or the natural horsemanship people or whoever they are. Like we're all in our little tiny worlds and we all kind of, we all wear the similar outfit that goes with that little world and we feed the supplements you're supposed to feed. And I don't think that's for the betterment of the horses. And I think because we've over-specialized, I think it leads to this sort of like overthinking that we talked about earlier in the podcast. So like if there's a particular training challenge, I think you overcomplicate the way to fix that challenge. Whereas I think if we all operated from a much, and I actually see this play out in boarding facilities that do have a bunch of like Western and English and trail riders all mixed together, I see people sort of diagnose different training situations in a more holistic way just because it's happening organically. Whereas I feel like people that are in their little bubble worlds really overcomplicate things. Like they really just start overthinking things.
That makes sense. You can kind of get blinders because you're only kind of seeing it from one perspective. I also grew up doing everything. I did 4-H and I had a little Morgan mare that I did barrel racing on and jumping and dressage and trail and all of it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
I had 6 saddles that I worked hard so I could buy them because I just wanted to do every event with her. And what it comes down to is good training is good training. And that's how I got into dressage because I had a guy who gave me free lessons in dressage and everything else improved dramatically without even working on it. And I was like, oh, this is what I want to do.
Oh, I love that story. That's so that's how it should be. That's so rewarding. That's so cool.
Yeah, so much. And she was very happy. She loved doing all of it. And I think it's important for dressage horses to see cows and go on trail rides. So that when you go into a dressage arena, they're used to seeing new weird things.
Indeed. Yeah, amen.
Yeah. Keep them entertained. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything?
No, not really. It's been an honor to be on your podcast. Hopefully listeners get something from it. I don't know. I'm always pretty humble and pretty shy to be on podcasts, but I love the work I do. I love the work that Equitopia is doing. I'm very excited about, I see the horse world shifting. I do. You know, we already acknowledge that, oh, wait a minute, maybe my horse is misbehaving because he has ulcers or he's in pain, you know, and that's a radical departure from when I was coming up in the horse training world. So I'm excited. I'm really optimistic for the future.
The internet is jam-packed with information and opinions on how to care for your horse, but how do you know what to trust? Equitopia membership programs are especially designed for busy people who want research and evidence-based resources and support for the best horse and rider experience. Our members tell us that they love Equitopia's amazing whole horse, whole rider resources that are available 24/7 from anywhere in the world. We are humbled by the many testimonials from horse people who tell us that Equitopia was the missing piece in their horsemanship journey and that our platform has changed their lives and the lives of their horses. We would like to offer you 50% off of your first month in any of our membership plans and start becoming a better informed equestrian today with our exclusive members' webinars, videos, the Equitopia Academy, and much more to support you on your journey. Just go to equitopiacenter.com and use the code PODCAST in the checkout to get your membership at half price for the first month.